Hey, what's going on, guys? Taxation is theft. I know it's been a really long time. Did you miss me? So I have here with me right now Eric Mulder, and he's running for Arapahoe County Sheriff in Colorado. Eric, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me, Dan. It's great to be here.
Awesome. So I think probably the first time I saw you was at the Libertarian Convention in New Orleans. What was that, like a month ago now?
Oh, yeah.
I'm totally losing track of time, but I saw you give an amazing speech up there, and that's when I was like, hey, this guy's pretty cool. So tell me, what's where do we start? Well, first tell me this. How did you become a libertarian? Let's start there.
All right. So I first became a libertarian shortly around the 2012 election, actually. I was in the United States Army at the time. And I'd received my mail-in ballot and I was going through the options, just trying to check them off. Wasn't living at my home of record at the time, so I wasn't very well plugged into the issues. In a weird way, it was kind of good because I was spared a lot of the TV commercials. And then it came down time to picking the presidential candidate. There was a couple of options, and I literally had to go to my liquor cabinet, get out some Jack Daniels, pour myself a shot, and take the shot and mark my ballot for the choice that I didn't want to make but felt that I had to make in order to stop the other candidate. And the day after I did that, I immediately went onto the Secretary of State's website and registered Libertarian because I said, I'm not voting for the lesser of two evils ever again.
Nice. Yeah, that was you said 2012, so that was I'm like all I'm thinking is Ron Paul, 'cause that's when I first learned about Ron Paul, I
Absolutely.
think.
I'd heard a little bit about him in 2008, but because the news was kind of pushing him off to the side and kind
Right.
of marginalizing him a bit, I didn't think much of him. I thought, it's the crazy candidate who ran again. But then I actually started paying attention to what he had to say, and he had a good couple of points that I thought were really good, especially because this was right around the time I'd just gotten back from my deployment to Afghanistan, did about 11 months there from about 2011 to 2012. And my experiences over there and what he was talking about, it really lined up with what I was feeling at the time. And so I said, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. Well, let's I know we I want to talk about your campaign and some other stuff, but while we're here, tell me about your experience in the Army, 'cause I know that's like always that's actually a really that can be a difficult topic sometimes because a lot of libertarians get accused of, "Oh, you don't care about the troops. You don't want to protect the country, you don't want to protect our freedom, all these other things." What's kind of your opinion on that?
Absolutely. Well, I spent about 6 years in the Army. I joined straight out of high school, spent a couple of years in that as a chaplain assistant, went around to various units. And I did deploy, like I said, back in 2011 to Afghanistan. We were about 2 hours away from the Pakistan border. And it was during my deployment that I saw the way the U.S. government conducted itself, like the way we were, quote unquote, helping out the people of Afghanistan. It wasn't doing any of them any good. The part of Afghanistan I was in wanted nothing to do with Afghanistan. They wanted to be part of Pakistan. And so they resented the Afghan government from the get-go, especially because the provincial governor was literally the brother of Hamid Karzai, the president at the time. And the politicians we were required to engage with and the generals we were required to work with, there was corruption to the very core of that system. And the opioid trade that people talk about, that's very true and very prevalent in that country. Corruption's not just part of the game in Afghanistan, it's practically a way of life in the political system. And just seeing that all, it's like I got the distinct impression we really weren't protecting anybody's freedom over there. So that's why whenever I go to peace rallies today to participate in peace events, I like to bring my Afghanistan veteran hat and carry my peace flag with me so I can say, the flag says peace and the hat says I mean it. And the military-industrial complex, it is deeply entrenched over there and in the Department of Defense. When I was in Afghanistan, the civilian contractors outnumbered us at least 2 to 1. And you can see this prevalent throughout several military units and the way we had to purchase things and the people we had to purchase them from. It was this revolting symbiosis between corporation and government just working together, colluding with one another. And this screws over a lot of people. So the military-industrial complex, I got to see that firsthand in the Army, and I can say that it's one of the big problems we're facing in this country.
Wow. Yeah, it's, I've heard a lot about that. Like, there was even, I heard one story about the laundry contracts where basically, you know, somebody who was a friend of some politician probably scored like this, and they were just like charging like $100 a load of laundry or something ridiculous. And it was really just like some fake system they set up to funnel money from the government into some private corporation, and it was all kind of a system there for profit. Is that DC? Oh, yeah.
What I saw was actually a lot of what appeared to me to be redundancy. Like, take for example, in the military, we have our own food preparation specialists. We have our own army cooks. Their jobs are literally to deploy and prepare meals for the army, get them transported around the battlefield, that sort of thing. Well, when we got to Afghanistan, there were contracted cooks who were preparing, serving, and distributing the food, which meant our cooks had to do things like convoy guard or other tasks that oftentimes had little to nothing to do with their own job. So you saw a lot of redundancy going on in Afghanistan. You'd see civilian contractors doing jobs that the military was more than capable of doing themselves.
Wow. So that's, and of course, like, these other people were getting paid tax money that was stolen from us, and they were getting paid a lot more than probably the military members were.
Absolutely. And then one of the other higher costs that you look at is you look at the cost of vehicle maintenance, because in the military, there is literally one contractor who can provide you with the vehicles and the replacement parts. And if that contractor has to raise the price of those goods, the military can't just say, we're going to go participate in a free market and find a third party provider to get this to us cheaper, because these contracts are set up all the way at the Joint Chiefs of Staff level. You have these contractors who have connections going deep inside the military. So we can't even use alternative options to save ourselves some money. It's literally that military industrial complex going on right there.
Man, that's crazy. And it's, man, it's like we're getting robbed, and then, you know, the money's going to one place, and then the place where that money is then getting robbed. Like, we're told, you know, the first robbery, oh, you're going to get some of it back. You know, we're going to build you roads and sell you all this other stuff. But nope, that all gets robbed away too into some corporate pocket.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And you see the same thing going on with foreign aid. Like, going back to my time in Afghanistan again, a lot of the money from the U.S. government that gets funneled to helping Afghanistan, quote unquote, rebuild, there's almost zero rebuilding effort going on from that country as it is. Most of that money is going right back to the politicians, who are using it to pay off others to buy their loyalty, because in Afghanistan, it's all about the tribe and not at all about the national government. To the Afghan, they identify as where they're from first, and Afghan secondary, even tetrary, or some places not even at all. And this is occurring all over the world in the United States. We're seeing this happen in places like Somalia and Libya, where our foreign policy is literally destroying these governments to install leaders who are friendly to the United States. And the people in these countries notice that. They might not have television and they might not have internet, but they are not dumb. They know what's going on and they don't appreciate it. So it's like that sarcastic battle cry goes, they must hate us for our freedom. And it's like, oh yeah, that it's just the freedom for sure. Wink.
Yeah. So like, I know there's a lot of people in the military who don't see this. Was this apparent to you, or like, was it a wake up call? Did you not think any of this stuff was going on, or did you just kind of go in with no, you know, like, what was your mentality when you kind of first saw this to be able to actually see it?
I would say this mentality definitely developed itself over time, and it was predominantly my deployment experience that helped me to reach this conclusion that our brand of helping isn't exactly helping any of these people out here, that we're literally supporting corrupt, nefarious governments who do unspeakably horrible things to their own people. And I did not know this at first going in. Like I said, I got out of the got into the military straight out of high school, and that occurs with a lot of people, actually. Many of them come straight out of high school, predominantly from the public school sector, and they're not talking about this sort of stuff in the public schools. Like the Afghanistan I saw, that's not the Afghanistan that's going to make it into the history books when this is over, if it will be over one day, because we're going on 17 years now in this conflict, and it doesn't sound like we're leaving anytime soon.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right about that. And yeah, it's, I mean, even if you consider that the same people who shape the history books are probably the same people that are shaping the media, and what we see on the media, even with, I mean, there are a lot of people who are just like you who are speaking out against this and saying that, you know, this is what's really going on. And for some reason, no matter how many people say that, no matter how many, and like you were there, you know it, you saw it firsthand, and somehow that's not a story that's being shown throughout the mainstream media at all. It's who's in charge of all that? It's probably all the same people that are writing the history books. Mm-hmm. So yeah,
absolutely.
Well,
what was that episode of that? You remember that 70s show? What was it that Hyde said? Real three branches of the government are the media, the military, and what was that third one?
Hollywood.
Yep, absolutely. That's it.
Yeah.
Something to that effect.
Yeah, it's so true. You know, and you got to give it to the hippies, because as much as they were, you know, just into drugs, which I'm learning now, like now that I'm an adult and I've actually tried some for myself, and I know a lot of people who are into like psychedelics and all this other stuff. It's really fascinating how the government even performed experiments to see that this, it kind of opened your mind to function better and more creatively and more efficiently, and then of course this came along and it all became criminalized. But then you have like Hyde who's hilarious, because it's like he's like that hippie, but at the same time it's like he knows things that nobody else knows, but only because you see them when you to put it in stoner terms, it's you see it when you're stoned, because that's just, you know, that's the stuff at work. But it's, I don't know, that's kind of funny how I guess the hippies are labeled as, you know, the crazy drug users, but they've really got some of the most insightful things to say about all that.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And that's what I like in the Libertarian Party. Just recently they've got a psychedelics caucus started, because there was actually a petition effort in Denver this year that was trying to get psychedelic legalization onto the ballot in the city of Denver. They didn't quite get enough signatures this time, because in Denver you got a petition to get onto the ballot, but they're going up again in 2020, and it's great to actually see that there's all these people out there who are starting to come to the realization that maybe what we've been told about psychedelics isn't 100% accurate, and maybe there's something to these things that we haven't been talking about for a really long time. So I absolutely love it when I see that there are other groups out there pushing to decriminalize the use of psychedelics and what people can actually experience and go through while they're on them, and how much of a positive effect it can have on people.
Right. And yeah, and they like, I mean, even I think it's PTSD, that they say mushrooms is actually really good for that. I don't quote me on that. Don't go get your prescription filled on that. But I think I recall reading something very similar like to that. I know CBD, you know, some people are using that, but, yeah, it's really interesting to see all these medical effects, and it's like, why has the government been making these things illegal for so long? And now you're in Colorado, which, you know, let's talk about that a little bit. You were saying, so it's legal there, but you were saying that your incarceration rates are actually going up right now. Mm-hmm. Even though, like, you would think, okay, well, if weed's legal, they're not going to be making so many arrests. How are they filling these jails up? What's going on there?
Oh, yeah. Well, where we're also seeing increases in incarceration, not just solely from marijuana use and possession, but we're seeing that in relation to other factors as well, especially with the ongoing immigration issues we're dealing with. A lot of people are finding themselves detained and thrown in jail for pretty much no reason that's been affirmed through the process of due process. Like, a lot of them have been denied their due process, the ability to talk to an attorney, things of that nature. But going back to marijuana, there's been several busts that have gone through throughout Colorado. It depends on the jurisdiction, because some places like Washington County, right next door to us in Arapahoe County, they seldom, if ever, had a problem. What we're predominantly finding is the people who want to distribute and work here in Colorado, they want this to be successful. They want marijuana to work here. So they've been fully cooperative with any sort of investigation. They've allowed inspections within constitutional constraints, making sure they get a warrant, things of that nature. But what we're also finding is that the states that have still made it illegal, there's still a black market demand for that marijuana. So sometimes distribution is coming from Colorado to these places. That's where some of the crackdowns are happening. So as libertarians, we're trying to sound the alarm, saying this is precisely why decriminalization needs to happen everywhere. It's great that it's happening on a state-by-state basis, but we would be very happy to see decriminalization happen across the entire United States. And the reason we say decriminalization and not legalization is that legalization implies a tax source. It implies a base for tax revenue. And what we found here in Colorado is that when a product is taxed high enough, people are going to try to get it at a black market rate that's below this. We even see this in New York with cigarettes, where the cigarette tax in New York is so high that there's still a market for loosies. That's why organized and even unorganized crime is selling loose cigarettes, so they can compete with the tax rate. And we see what government's willing to do to people who don't comply with taxes. Look at what happened to Eric Garner. He was strangled to death for selling a loose cigarette. And we're finding that in Colorado, where municipalities are either taxing the marijuana extremely high or they're still applying restrictions. The city where I live, for example, recreational marijuana is legal to sell, but medical marijuana is not. So what we're finding here in our own city is that with medical marijuana not being permitted to be sold in the city, people are going out of town to get their medical marijuana prescriptions filled. So that means they're going to get gas out of town, they're going to pick up a snack out of town, and eventually they're going to sit down for lunch or dinner, and they're going to do some shopping out of town. So those second and third order effects just from the legalization aspect are tremendous, which is why I love being part of the Libertarian Party, because we say decriminalization is infinitely superior to legalization.
Absolutely. But now I'm trying to wrap my head around this. How is it legal to have recreational and illegal to have medical?
Well, in the state of Colorado, we have what's known as home rule municipalities. That means that municipal governments, if they write a home rule charter, that means they can ignore specific aspects of state law, which Amendment 64, which amended the Colorado Constitution to allow the sale of recreational marijuana, it is silent on what municipalities can or can't ban in terms of marijuana within their own city. So you've got cities like mine where recreational is legal to sell, but medical is not legal to sell. And you've got some jurisdictions that have basically stymied efforts to get recreational sold within the city, but they've done it in that legalese sort of way, where they use that legal language and special code to try to make it to where they're not technically obstructing Colorado state law, but at the same token, they're sticking to that home rule provision that allows them to basically thwart efforts to introduce these things. And what we're also finding too is that the marijuana industry in Colorado has become very heavily corporatized. There are a small number of chains that have essentially dominated the market. And some of these chains, much like other major corporations who've gotten in bed with government, have basically stymied efforts to thwart their own competition. This industry is very new, and it's already playing by the rules of the old game, where recreational dispensaries lobby to keep medical out of the city because medical, in some regards, is a competitor of theirs. And we're also finding that while it's great that these new industries have popped up, we still have people in prison and in jail in Colorado for possession and distribution of marijuana when it was illegal. And even though we've made it decriminalized and we've legalized it, these people, who are predominantly people of color, actually are still in jail and still in prison for these offenses. So Amendment 64 is kind of a bittersweet provision, because on the one hand, it's great that we're bringing it out of the black market, but at the same token, so many people have just been frozen out of what was supposed to be done with this.
Right. Wow, that's interesting. And yeah, it's man, that's interesting what you're saying about corporations. Like, it's basically what, like the Walmart of marijuana now, that's becoming the king seller of the entire state. Is that kind of what it looks like it's heading towards?
It's kind of shaping up to be that way. I would say it's a little bit closer to almost the cell phone industry, where there's a good couple of chains competing with one another, but ultimately these chains aren't doing much to make the industry itself more competitive. Like they've said, even though we can't have the entire pie, this portion of pie we've currently got is good enough, and we won't have to worry about upstarters kicking us off the throne.
Right. So is it difficult? Like, if I just wanted to go there and I wanted to start my own dispensary, is there a lot of red tape and permits and fees and everything to go through? Or
absolutely. I spoke to a gentleman a couple of years ago who was trying to look into getting his own dispensary started, and because with the federal government constantly forcing headaches on us through that wonderful attorney general's office, we're finding that one of the biggest challenges in the marijuana industry is trying to get banks to accept it, because at the federal level, the federal right. government is still saying absolutely positively not. So most banks and bank chains are very hesitant to take money from marijuana industries. So we're still looking at a predominantly cash industry. And what that's led to is that you have to have literal hard cash assets to get started. The same gentleman I was speaking to said, with getting the product, getting the space, getting the licensing, and meeting the requirements of various municipalities, because going back to home rule, each city in Colorado is going to have its own marijuana enforcement division with its own rules on top of the state marijuana enforcement division. He said he was looking at a minimum six figures in hard cash assets
Wow.
just to get his foot in the door. So it's become a really expensive industry to get into, which goes back to the libertarian position of legalization causes these problems, decriminalization doesn't.
Yeah, I mean, you're saying it costs a couple hundred grand at least to get your foot in the door, and I'm thinking, man, as a high school graduate, I was able to start my own marijuana dispensary business on the black market with like a couple hundred bucks.
Absolutely. That's why the black market still isn't going away, because even though the dispensaries can offer easier to obtain products, they still have a market in Colorado simply because they've got lower overhead and they can undercut the chains and they can undercut the tax rate.
Right. And of course, the chains could somehow say, oh, well, these other guys they're competing with us. They're able to make lower prices because they don't have to put all these taxes on them. So let's go rat them out to the cops and get the black market shut down.
Absolutely.
So yeah, that's crazy. And this is really the same thing we see with Uber and Lyft and every business imaginable. It's always the same. Like, everyone thinks these licenses and fees and everything, like, it's there for our protection. No, it's absolutely not. It's there so that corporations can basically form monopolies and kick everybody else out of the market and jack their prices up.
Absolutely. And what we're finding with more and more with licensing, and what's really great, is that you can get some people on the left side of the political spectrum, which some libertarians are like, oh no, we don't have anything in common with that side of the spectrum. But what's great is that when you talk to people from that sort of mindset, they're rallying against the same occupational licensing requirements that we are, because they're pointing out rightfully that this keeps out marginalized people, such as those with prior criminal convictions, people of color, people from poor backgrounds. These occupational licensing requirements, whether it's for an occupation or for a business or any type of entrepreneurship, they're finding that these licensing requirements keep these people from being able to engage in honest enterprise with one another, to engage in honest trade. And it's relegated them to having to take jobs working for somebody else who can get these licensing and these fees, right, and pay for the all this other stuff that the government requires. Because a lot, like you said, this licensing is not done to keep unscrupulous actors from getting into the market. It's often used to keep enterprising up-and-comers from being able to get their foot in the door and being able to take charge of their own lives.
Yeah. It's crazy. And it's, yeah, it's something that, as shocking as it is, I think a lot of people still don't see that. It's that's probably one of the hardest things to wake people up to. Because I guess until you actually try to start the business and see how much government's in your way, you just don't know. It's kind of transparent to you. It's hidden from you.
Oh, yeah. It reminds me of the libertarian joke, going back to the movie The Purge, where crime is legal for 24 hours in a day. The libertarian, right, joke is, crime is legal for 24 hours a day. What are you going to do? Fish without a license, start a business without a permit, engage in tax-free enterprise. And that's like, you don't know how the Purge works, do you, libertarians? It's like, oh, no, we perfectly understand how the Purge, yeah, works. We're just, yeah, looking at it in a way that others might not consider. And it might not make for a very good movie, but that's honestly what most of us would do.
Well, you know what I thought was really interesting about that is because so many people think like, oh, a libertarian society is going to look like the Purge. But now this new Purge movie is coming out. Maybe it's, I don't even follow movies anymore, but maybe it's already out.
I think they're like up to four now or something.
Yeah. But so like the latest one that I saw, they're like, it's like a prequel. It's the very first Purge ever. And it turns out, like, they did this purge, everything's legal, and no one did anything. Nobody was breaking, no one was killing people, nobody was robbing and stealing and doing all this other stuff. And the government had to send in kind of like their agent provocateurs to kind of encourage people to do all these violent things and start killing each other to I guess the main thing was to, like, thin out the population.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And what's funny is we've seen this happen in real life, too. Like, take a look at our own government, for example. The FBI is engaged in COINTELPRO against,
yep,
domestic organizations right here at home. Even Ron Paul brought up back during World War I, the government was spying on churches even who were opposed to the First World War. And government has a long and storied history of sabotaging grassroots movements at that level.
Yep. And I have this feeling that's already... I mean, I already know it's in play right now with the Libertarian Party. Like, I don't know exactly how it's working, but I just know, like, sometimes when I go to the conventions, I'm like, okay, I know that, like, at least, like, before I thought it was a quarter. Now I'm like, maybe it's a half of these people are here, like, they're here working for someone. They're not here to be a part of freedom. Like, it's, do you ever get that feeling from anybody at the convention?
It's really interesting you bring that up, because Gary Gygax, the founder of Dungeons and Dragons,
mm-hmm,
after he passed away, there was an FBI file written on the guy, and they were documenting his activities within the Libertarian Party, his activities,
wow,
through Dungeons and Dragons. So the federal government has been doing this to people since day one, and for our party, easily since day one, because Gary Gygax was one of the members who was there right from the beginning. And the FBI was keeping tabs on him. So if the FBI has been doing this since 1971, it's pretty easy to logically conclude that they're probably continuing some sort of activity to that extent.
Yeah.
Edward Snowden proved that
goes
much deeper than any of us could ever imagine.
Yeah. And that was, man, how long ago was Snowden's leak now?
I know. And it's so disappointing sometimes, because he pretty much gave up pretty much everything to tell us this information. And it almost,
yeah,
seems as if not much has changed, especially with regard to the news, like you said, because when's the last time the NSA was mentioned, or the CIA, right, or FBI, or any sort of surveillance program was talked about in the news.
And I know they still have their data centers open. They're probably still operating at full capacity. And what's kind of scary is, like, if the Snowden leaks were, like, I want to say they were 10 years ago, but I know it hasn't been that long. But the rate at which technology develops, like, I already know the stuff that we saw from that leak is, like, they've already outdone themselves, like, probably tenfold. And there's, like, much scarier things that they have now to be worried about.
Yeah, absolutely. That's why I like organizations like the EFF. They're always on the forefront, making sure that cybersecurity and our cyber privacy is always protected. I especially loved it when groups came out against the CIA and the FBI trying to advocate for a backdoor to electronic devices so that way they could get around password locks, which a lot of people correctly pointed out, if people who are supposed to be able to get around these backdoors can do that, the people who aren't supposed to be able to can do that as well, because that's pretty much the game of cybersecurity. It's a never-ending game of cat and mouse where the black hat hackers are always outdoing the white hat people working for the agencies to upkeep the cybersecurity. It's a constant game of one-up, just like the techniques that are used to quote-unquote break Vegas. Breaking Vegas was a documentary series on history a while back that discussed the ways people cheated Las Vegas, either through using software, card tricks, counting cards, things of that nature. And as the security measures to stop those cheating tactics increase, so did the intricacies of the cheating methods. It's the same principle with cybersecurity. It's that constant game of one-upping each other.
Yeah, it's interesting. That's it's funny. Like, it's kind of a game, but it's a game that most people don't even know that they're playing. Like, you're like almost, well, pretty much every, I guess I could say every American is a pawn in this game. And yeah, most of them don't even realize that they're in the game.
Oh yeah, absolutely. It's like when people are shocked that Facebook shows them an ad that's related to something they were talking about, when on their settings, their microphone is on, they've got cookies enabled. And when they're browsing on websites that download cookies, those go right back to Facebook. So
yeah, it's like, have you guys not been paying attention? Your technology is listening to you.
Oh yes, absolutely.
Yeah. So let's talk more about your campaign. So you're running for sheriff. What's your competition like on that? Because I know usually it's difficult for libertarians. How does it look for you?
Well, this race has actually been very interesting because my competition is a Republican and a Democrat. And what's unique about that is this is the exact same Republican and the exact same Democrat who ran against each other in 2014. The Republican was the incumbent sheriff and the Democrat was the challenger. And it's exactly the same except for myself. And a couple of people have noticed that, actually. There are a few people who are saying, you're the only thing that's different about this race. What's been fantastic is that sheriff's races are notorious for being uneventful when they really shouldn't have to be. Because in most sheriff races, we hear how the sheriff and his competitor, they talk about how long they've lived in the county. They've talked about how long they've lived in the state. They talk about how long they've been on the force. And it's like, that's all fine and dandy, but what are you doing? And how do you do something with this office? What are you up to, actually? And that seldom, if ever, gets talked about. So as a libertarian with my own limited non-experience in law enforcement, I've never been in law enforcement, but I do have military experience. Because I'm not relying on that experience card, I am more free to talk about the issues we're facing within law enforcement and our country in general. So I've been able to talk about things such as demilitarizing the police, decriminalizing victimless crime behaviors, and ensuring that we follow due process for everybody. And just by talking about these issues that people are concerned about, it's a breath of fresh air in this race. And this has led me to become the second highest fundraiser in a three-way race. The Republican's been able to out-fundraise me because he has richer friends than I do. But what's been great is that I've been able to hit up my friends, family, and individuals on the street for $5 donations, $10 donations. These small donations are the one that adds up pretty quick. I like to say I'm running on change and on change.
Nice. That's pretty cool. So, what's kind of like your main platform that like your, how do you present yourself to most people? Like, is there, are there like any doubts that people have about you because you don't have the law enforcement experience? Is there, you know, what kind of conversations do you have?
Those concerns do come up sometimes, but the second I mentioned my military background, how I spent 6 years in the Army and 11 months in Afghanistan, so I understand a lot of the dangers that deputies can face and a lot of the issues they have to deal with at home because I was a chaplain assistant. So the issues we dealt with in the Army, such as suicidal ideation, post-traumatic stress disorder, sleep deprivation, and the related issues, a lot of people in law enforcement are dealing with them as well. So when I bring up my background stating I've worked with soldiers trying to get them help in this regard, and I want to bring that mindset to the sheriff's department, people aren't as concerned when I have a lack of experience. When I mention that I want to use the position of my office and the power and position behind the badge to advocate for criminal justice reform, that gets a lot of people's attention too. Because even as sheriff, even though as sheriff I can't change any laws, as sheriff, I can advocate for those changes, and I can be that face for criminal justice reform, stating I'm in the position to oversee people inside the jail until their trial happens. So we got to stop this mindset of everyone in jail is a criminal, because most people are in jail because they're awaiting trial. At least 60% of people are. And of that 60%, most of them are in there because they literally can't afford bail. So when you have justices across the country who are actually experimenting in bail bond reduction, that's a positive thing. And I want to use my office to highlight that, stating this is a good thing that's happening, because when people can afford bail, that means they can stay at their job until their trial happens. That means they can pay their rent, they can pay their bills, they can take care of their families, and they can take care of themselves. Because if they're just rotting in jail waiting for their trial date, which could take months or in some cases even years to set, that's a person who can't take care of themselves, who can't give back into their own communities through commerce and entrepreneurship. That is somebody who is trapped and stuck, and that not only costs them their livelihood, but that costs us in the long term as well. So when I'm running on a platform of using alternatives to incarceration, that gets a lot of people's attention. And when I tell them this can save us money and actually reduce crime, they really start paying attention.
Yeah, that's interesting. But so one thing you said, I want to challenge you on this, because it's I hear this from a lot of candidates running for sheriff, that you can't change the law. But the reality is, you do have some sort of discretion in what laws to enforce. Like, it's not like, so there's a difference between the police and the mm-hmm. sheriff, where the police are essentially hired by an incorporated city, and they're, mm-hmm. you know, if they don't enforce the laws that they're told to enforce, they can be fired. But the sheriff mm-hmm. is an elected position, and you have more discretion to say, I don't believe that this is a crime, and even though it's a law that was passed by Congress, I'm not going to enforce it. And you're kind of the king of the county. You are the I mean, except for arguably the attorney general, I guess. You are the highest level executor of that county, and you can say we're not going to be enforcing this law in this county. Because it's a bad law. It's immoral. It's wrong to enforce that. And there's nothing that can be done except for, I mean, you know, let's say we're not going to arrest murderers. You did something stupid like that. Then of course you could be impeached. But when it comes to, you know, enforcement of drug laws, like let's say, you know, it's still illegal to sell, weed on the black market. You as sheriff can say, you know, me nor any of my deputies will arrest somebody for black market drug dealing. I mean, of course, you know, once your term's up, then those people still have that problem to deal with the next guy that comes in. But mm-hmm. you still have the authority to do that. And there are, as far as I know, no consequences, no negative consequences for you for doing so, because you have that power.
Absolutely. And I'm 100% glad you brought that up, because there was actually a libertarian who was elected sheriff in Colorado several years ago named Bill Masters out in San Miguel County. And he's been the sheriff of his county for several decades. He's not a libertarian anymore for reasons I don't know, but he brought that mindset to the sheriff's department. And he pointed out that as sheriff, he has a lot of discretion in deciding who does or doesn't go to jail. And what's also interesting that you pointed out is that in the Colorado Revised Statutes, which actually talks about the office of sheriff and outlines the actual roles and responsibilities of the sheriff, law enforcement is not what it's called. It's actually called peacekeeping. So the big difference there is that keeping the peace is very distinctive from law enforcement, because law enforcement is, like you said, it's that municipal police mindset. It's that we got to write this fine and we got to give out this ticket and we've got to collect this revenue from this delinquent fine payer. Whereas with peacekeeping, the mindset is, what are we doing to make sure that the county is safe? Is it safer to engage in this fine and collect mindset, kick down doors and no-knock warrants being served, or is it safer to ensure that nobody is getting hurt? And that's what's great about the office of sheriff, is that as a libertarian candidate, we very much have the capacity as sheriff to say, if no one is being harmed right now, we're prioritizing our efforts to people who are actually engaging in harm. The time it takes us to engage in drug busts and shutting down these black market activities, we could be dealing with actual issues that people are dealing with. There's been an increase of actually vehicle break-ins around neighborhoods, which as sheriff, that's my responsibility to look into and make sure we're actually keeping an eye out on these neighborhoods and keeping people safe, because destroying somebody's car to get to their valuables, putting their car on cinder blocks to steal their tires, that's a legitimate crime that has a legitimate victim. And as sheriff, our obligation is to uphold the peace. And I brought that up a couple of times, actually, where people have asked, so sheriff, if there's a law that you don't agree with, would you not enforce it? To which I've stated, like I said, my job as sheriff is to be a peacekeeper, and my oath is to the Constitution. If there's a law that is passed that's unconstitutional, my oath to the Constitution supersedes this unconstitutional law. And if people don't like the way that I'm enforcing the peace and keeping the peace going, they know how to check a box on a ballot and they know how to vote and they can find somebody else to run for sheriff.
Awesome. That's really awesome to hear, because there are not that many sheriff candidates, especially, I mean, even in the Libertarian Party, who are willing to say that. So that's you got my vote right there with that. That's pretty awesome. So I guess, is there anything, if there's anybody listening in Colorado, who wants to help out with your campaign, make a donation, volunteer, do you have a website? What are you trying to do? What are your goals with the campaign? What do you need, in order to, make this thing a success?
Absolutely. Volunteers are critical to this campaign. I'm going to be needing people to knock doors in September. I'm going to need people to make phone calls. I'm going to need people to make contributions, because like I said, I'm the second highest fundraiser in a three-way race, but we got to keep that momentum going, because I have to order signs. I got to order leaflets. I got to order other campaign materials. I got to pay for advertisements on social media, because that's where the people are. So anybody out there who wants to help, MulderForSheriff.com is my website. You can follow me on Facebook and Twitter and on Instagram at Mulder, M-U-L-D-E-R, for Sheriff. And another person to reach out to is the membership director of the Libertarian Party of Colorado. His name is Matt DiGiallinardo. He goes by Matt DG. That's my campaign manager. His contact information's on the Libertarian Party of Colorado website. He'll be able to find a task for you to do. I can always use the help, and I appreciate everybody's support.
Awesome. Yeah, so if you're watching this, if you're in Colorado, if you have friends in Colorado, definitely, do what you can, guys, because it's I don't want to get too sales pitchy here, but especially as libertarian candidates, we are up against a giant machine. Like the corporations are giving money to basically, you know, people who are going to run for office and who are going to enforce, you know, they're going to work for these corporations. And so libertarian candidates, the reason, the main reason I think it's so difficult for us to win, and some of us are winning, is that you know, we're not for sale. And so it's, you know, it's, we need a lot of help in terms of volunteers and actually, you know, helping us get the word out there. And you know, it's, if you can volunteer, I give this talk like every time I have a candidate on, probably. If you can volunteer just a couple hours a week, like, it's a couple hours a week. You don't have to become like a full-time volunteer or anything. Like, even if you can do a couple hours, like, that's really a huge help, because in a couple hours you can probably talk to, you know, 20 or 30 people. And if 10 or 50 volunteers talk to 10 or 20 people, now you're in the hundreds and thousands of people that we're reaching, who are learning something new about, you know, getting somebody elected who is actually going to cause real change. And I don't really like to do too much in the way of endorsements, but from what I've heard from Eric just now, especially, like, you know, being one of the very few sheriff candidates who are willing to say, I'm not going to enforce unjust, unethical, and unconstitutional laws, I think that alone is, like, monumental. that's my soapbox speech for now. Yeah, wow. So, man, I'm just like, I have nothing else to say, because that's just like, that made my day, man. Thanks for saying
glad
that.
I could do that, Dan.
I guess, is there anything else, anything else you want to talk about, particularly with your campaign? I know we kind of went over, you know, what the scene looks like for your campaign. Are there any other, you know, specific issues that you think, you know, you can make a difference in? Like, what about police misconduct or anything like that? Is that anything that you've been able to address or?
Absolutely, because that has been a very important issue in not only the city I live in, but the county I live in as well. In the sheriff's department, two deputies within 2 years were caught driving under influence, and one of them had a loaded firearm and was transporting a prisoner,
a person
who had been convicted and found guilty and was being transported from the jail to prison, because a sheriff, that's one of our jobs, is to transport convicted persons to prison to serve their sentences. So this person got caught completely drunk while on duty, and they had their loaded firearm, their duty weapon, with them. And this individual and the one that came before him got probation, which, if it was you or I who did this, we would be looking at a minimum several years in prison and easily being put on a list that denies us the ability to purchase a firearm. So when the public sees that there are special advantages, whether intentional or not, that deputies will get that's denied to everyone else, that really does hurt public trust. And that means the public's not going to be as willing to accept law enforcement or to cooperate with law enforcement or even work with us or just be members of the same community with us. So when those types of things happens, it doesn't matter how much public outreach a sheriff's department or a police department does. All that public outreach goes out the window when people see this special privilege system going on. Because even if it might not be special privileges, most people know in the back of their head, if I did what this guy did, I would be looking at years of prison time and I would be looking at years of jail time. So that really does hurt public trust.
Yeah, and it's amazing how they pull it off, and so many people they still buy it.
Absolutely.
They think,
and
oh,
there's even
it's just some, you know, oh, there must have been some strange circumstances. Maybe he wasn't that drunk. you know.
Absolutely. And what we're finding is this militarized approach to law enforcement as well, in which the objective isn't so much to bring a peaceful resolution about the situation, it's to resolve the situation as quick as possible. which is the militarized approach to law enforcement. And what we're finding is that this has had very deadly results, not only for people who are on duty, but this is also really deadly for citizens too. Just in my own city, there was a call that went out to the local police because there were shots that were happening at a home. So neighbors thought a burglary was happening. And the police got on scene, kicked in the door. Door was already broken into, so they didn't have to do much forcible entry. But they got into the house. They saw a man with a gun. They shot the man who had the gun. And then what happened was that the man they shot and killed who had the gun had shot and killed the person who broke into their home.
Oh, wow.
So when that type of approach to policing is done, that legitimately scares people. People have a genuine concern that law enforcement is going to do this to them. Because now we have cases where people are rightfully defending their own home with deadly force if necessary, because that's what Castle Doctrine is, going all the way back to common law days. People who are engaging in a legitimate form of self-defense might not even be safe in their own home. So as sheriff, the mindset we need to bring is, instead of resolving a situation as quick as possible, let's make sure we resolve it correctly. We don't necessarily have to bring every situation to a conclusion immediately. And what's interesting is that if you speak to older law enforcement officials, guys who've been retired for several years, that was the mindset they were trained to do. If there was a barricaded individual and there were no hostages and nobody was in the immediate line of fire or anything like that, the old mindset was to wait out the barricaded person. And if the person did have, say, hostages or was actively shooting at other people, that's when you had to bring in the SWAT team, because that's what it was created for in the 70s. But what we're finding now is that the SWAT mentality, which was supposed to be last resort, worst case scenario, the SWAT style tactics are being used increasingly more and more as the years have gone by. There's actually only one state in the United States that reports SWAT team usage statistics, and that's Utah. So what I want to bring to the sheriff's office where I live is that maybe we need to start reporting what we're doing with our own SWAT teams. Maybe we need to not engage in these serving of warrants through the no-knock style, because what they're finding with no-knock warrants and this militarized mindset in general is that police kick down the door. It's a no-knock warrant, so they're not announcing themselves. It's the middle of the night. Homeowner hears their home getting broken into. They don't hear police or anything of that nature. So what does a firearms homeowner do? They pick up their firearms and they engage who they believe is an intruder. And there's actually been cases in places like Detroit where gangs will actually get materials and equipment that look like police materials, police uniforms, and mimic these no-knock style warrants so they can break into people's homes and burglarize them. Gangs are actually adopting these tactics. So when the police are engaging in no-knock warrants, homeowners are going to become rightfully afraid that they're being attacked by somebody who's not the police. And what we're finding more and more is that grand juries are increasingly siding with homeowners in these cases. Because if the police don't make any attempt to identify themselves, or in some cases, even if they do identify themselves, these juries are realizing that anyone can claim to be the police when engaging in a no-knock warrant. So if somebody has no way of knowing if it's the police or not, they have every right to protect their home from what they believe to be an intruder. And what's actually been safer for law enforcement in the past is, instead of issuing a no-knock warrant, they scope out the place that they want to search, wait for the person to leave, and then either apprehend the person in a public place where they're not barricaded with their weapons and entrenched, ready for a fight. And if they don't have to get the person, then they can search the place when the person's not home and then leave before they even get there. Because the rationale behind the no-knock warrant is that, well, if we knock, then they're going to flush drugs or they're going to get their weapons, which it's like,
who cares?
All the more reason to wait for them to be out of their home, because people do have to leave their home eventually. And it's easier to pick somebody up while they're getting their mail or going to McDonald's than it is to try to take them in their barricaded home where they're waiting for you.
Yeah, that's And guys, if you're listening, this is one reason I say, like, the jury duty letters that they send you, they're backed with a false threat that you're going to go to jail or you're going to get fined $10,000 or something ridiculous. That's bullshit. But go do the jury duty anyway, because I mean, these cases like these are happening all the time, and we need good people to basically, like, that was kind of a something that they put in the Constitution to give us one last little leg of power against this government that they knew was going to turn into this cancerous beast that was going to try to take away all of our rights and throw us all in prison and all this other stuff. So it's if there are so many people that will side with the cops no matter what, and in these times when they are really, really, really wrong, like breaking into someone's house, in the middle of the night with their guns and not announcing that they're police, and someone legitimately is trying to defend their own home, like we need people in these juries that can say, "No, sorry, policeman, but you were in the wrong, and you should be going to prison for what you did because you're the one who put lives in risk." So, think about that the next time you get a jury duty summons. Anyway, man, it's been really awesome talking with you. You really know your stuff on a lot about this, and I have to say you're very libertarian there. No, it's really refreshing to see someone who's running for sheriff that has this mentality, because that is pretty rare. And it's really great to hear that you actually do know so much about all these different issues, and you're not one of these people who's just kind of throwing their hat in the ring and saying, "I'm going to run for something." You actually know your issues really well, which to me goes much further than actual experience because it's like sometimes you got to see things from a different perspective than somebody who's been, somebody who's got 10 years of experience in law enforcement. Okay, yeah, maybe you've learned a lot of things and you know how certain things work, but you've been trained from day one to think and react a certain way, and you've never really had an opportunity to look at everything objectively. So, I think that's actually really to your advantage on this. I guess, do you have anything else you want to add in before we wrap this up?
One last thing I would like to add in terms of reaching audiences we don't typically get to reach. My first debate is coming up on August 4th. It's going to be a members-only debate with the Fraternal Order of Police. I'm not going to be able to live stream it, unfortunately, but it's another opportunity for me to engage in an audience I don't normally get to talk to. And I will be wearing the same
That's
button
awesome.
that I've got on here, because my job as running for sheriff is I might not necessarily be able to win over this crowd. I know there might be some in this audience who are not going to be very receptive to the message I'm saying, which is all the more reason to deliver that message, because people need to know what libertarians are about and where we stand. And they need to know that should I become their future sheriff, they need to know what mindset I'm going to bring to the table.
Absolutely. I'm trying to read the button, but it's kind of small from over here. What does it say?
Button says abolish asset forfeiture.
Oh, nice. Definitely. Actually, I think somebody posted that in the comments. Maybe they could read the button. That's awesome. That's another big one. Man. All right, Eric. Well, I wish you the best of luck, and maybe we'll do another follow-up sometime before the election. And if there's anything you want to send me that I can share on the page, anything I can do to help, definitely feel free to reach out.
I'd be glad to, Dan. Thank you so much. It's been an absolute wonderful time tonight.
Awesome. Thanks for coming on. We
Happy
will
to do it.
see you again, and taxation is theft.
Absolutely.